Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
But when we leave the body, St. Paul said, lost enemy that we have to conquer that we have to conquer is death. How to conquer that? What is death? Death is no bugbear. It is simply a change. You see? The indweller of the house is gone. You see? You have to leave this physical body, transcend it, go where we know not so far. If we know ourselves who we are, by practical sense analysis, then we will be able to know where it goes as well. But we are living in the world as it were. We are the body itself, nothing more. We are looking to the world from the angle of the body and not the soul, you see. The matter have become very complicated, I would say. We are in a grand delusion. Just think for a moment, I would say, how? The learned are the unlearned. The rich are the poor. You see? King are the subject. Any of them, you see, is having this body now. He has to leave the body someday. Date not fixed, not known, you see. For instance, a student has to appear in some examination and that day draws near. What does he do? He leaves off all unnecessary routine of life, you see. He takes to what is going to help him for appearing in the examination, you see. When the date draws still near, say, 3 weeks or so is left, what does he do? He simply leaves off playing also, you see. And sometimes when he goes to the calls of nature, he takes a book even along with him, you see, for an examination for which some date is fixed. How cautious, how careful we are. But for a change that nobody can escape, and for which no date is fixed, should we not prepare ourselves the earliest possible hour? And what is that preparation, you see? You must learn this withdrawal of the spirit from the body. This is a practical question to be learned at the feet of some who have got that personal experience and is competent to give you that experience. When you go to him, what does he say? He says, well, look here. Man is composed of physical body, intellect, and soul. You develop physically. Body is the temple of God. It's a very valuable thing. It's the highest of all creation. It is said in Quran of Prophet Muhammad that when creation was made, the man body was made and life was infused into it, man bodies. God ordered angels to pay homage, you see, to the man body. It is higher than the angels themselves, you see. This is a very golden opportunity that we have got, but we are now only what we are doing, see, just calmly consider all this. we do care for the outer cleanliness of the body, no doubt. But we care little or nothing for the inward cleanliness. We are defiling the body with the thoughts of lust, anger, greed, attachment, and egoistic life. Every moment we are polluting it, you see, instead of cleansing it from inside. That's one part of it. And the other one is that just we are dirt. From the physical point of view, we have done so much, we have learned so much how to maintain our physical body and how to maintain our household life, how to maintain our social bodies and political life. We have learned so much. Intellectually, we have also dwelt very wonderfully. We have made very great inventions. We have telepathy, we have got television. We can fly in the air at tremendous rate, speed of speed. We have got telephones and so much. But just consider what we know about our own selves. The physical body and the intellect both depend on soul in the body. When soul leaves the body, everything remains here. The first is the body. When we are born with us, when we enter the world, that's the first companion that we have. But when we leave the body, the body left here. When we go, the body left here. Now consider for a moment the first companion that we had while coming to the world that does not accompany us, how those things which have come in our contact through the body, can they accompany us? Not. But we are now, see how we are just behaving as if this body will remain forever. We never in dream think of that we have to leave the body someday. If we close our eyes, for instance, a pigeon, seeing a cat coming in front, he simply closes. We only know when he is in the the claws of the cat. Similarly, you do not care to remember that we have to leave the body someday, that day will come, must come, no exception to it. So, but we are doing, what we are doing for that? We have done so much out of the 24 hours, you see. People meet me, I ask them what time you are going to put in for that. He said, we have got no time. Even when they are put on, they have put in more time on this. Well, we have no time. We have to earn money. We have to maintain our family. That's all right. Out of the 24 hours. Hell, work for your body. Put in 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours, 20 hours for the maintenance of your families, your body, earning things, this and that thing. But at least you should do something for knowing your very self. Well, it is you who have to leave the body. At that time you do not know how to leave the body. You will be undergoing the agony, nobody else. And for that, you've got no time. If you go to a businessman, he says, look here, I've got no time. If you go to some, who is doing some work in any shop or in government office, you ask him, he says, he's got no time. Excuse me, those men who are on pension even, if you go to them, they say, we have got no time. But new life. How important it is, the knowing of the oneself, but we care little or nothing for it. Our pursuit in the way of the spiritual advancement is simply confined just we attend church once a week or read some lines of Bible or other holy scripture. And that's enough. Majority of the people going to attend church or other holy place of worship, if you go and ask them sincerely, well, what for are you coming over to the church or the holy place of worship? Why are you reading these scriptures? You find in majority of the cases, they will say, well, for the reason that, so that I may learn my livelihood, God may grant us and grant me that. My relative is sick so that he may be recover and he may grant us the other things required for worldly life. For that reason we are going to the church. The majority of them will tell you like that. They are such like people, even if they remember, they simply do that part of the show simply for the reason that they will have the worldly life. How many there are who really attend the holy places of worship or read the holy scriptures for the sake of knowledge, knowing oneself and knowing God, for the love of God, I say. Very few. So you see now their values of life. We have got the physical life, we have the intellectual life, we have the spiritual life. We have just overtopped our physical, intellectual side, even the self. Matter is riding the soul. Well, it was soul that had to ride the matter. The case is quite reversed. Horse was to be put in front of the cart, you see. We are putting cart in front of the horse when they have come up. Just think for a moment, you meet with some accident and you are wearing on a very beautiful apparel, very costly, and that is worn out, torn out. What you say? Well, I am saying, don't fear, rest assured. At another accident, which is an unfortunately your leg or bomb is broken, what you say? I am saved. You see, body is more valuable than the apparel we are wearing. When a man goes sick, there is very little hope of his life. One does say, all right, sell away all possessions, or spend all money in the bank, so that I may recover. So body is more valuable than the possessions and all finances are with us. And life is more valuable than the body itself, you see. That is why I should say, is not body more than the raiment? And life more than the meat? So there are values and values, you see. We have values for the physical life. Master, don't say that you do not care for the body. It is the temple of God. Maintain it, you see. You have got family, children. Well, God is eyes in every heart. You have got duties towards them. Well, perform them sincerely and love them. You have got intellect. You should develop intellectually also. But if you do not know yourself, you see, who will help you at the time when you leave the body, sometime, someday? At the last moment, you see, even the most sympathetic relation, maybe wife, husband, son, brother, daughter, friends, even doctors, they stand by helpless, cannot help you. You are leaving the body, you are passing through the agony of death, and nobody knows, nobody is there to help you. It is said, you see, in the Quran of the Prophet Muhammad that when soul leaves the body, pain is felt just like a thorny bush is put into the rectum and dragged out through the mouth. There's some simile, you see, comparison given. The scriptures of the Hindus say man feels pain at the time of death just like 1,000 scorpions bite at one moment. You are the eyewitness, you see. When a man dies, how he feels. Very rare cases you will find if they pass out calmly, peacefully. Otherwise, they are at the loss. Sometimes they just have convulsions, eyes are upturned, face is sometimes yellow, some haggard, like that. How important. But how insignificant we have dealt with, you see. Very lightly we have taken that thing. That is why the masters who have been coming in the past, they have been just laying stress. Well, look here, your present life, you consider that you are on exile, you see. You have come on a pilgrimage to the earth. It is a temporary abode in which you are living. You have to leave it someday. No exception to the law. Irrespective, you may belong to one country or the other, or one social living or the other. That is the mystery of life that you have to solve for your own self, you see. Unless you have solved that mystery of life for you, you are nowhere. Man's life consisted not in the abundance of the possessions he has got, you see. Is not, again I will repeat, life more than the meat and body more than the raiment. There are things of higher value and still higher value, you see. The most highest of all values that we have before us is our own self, knowledge of the self. Saint Plutarch says the soul experience has the same experience at the time of death when leaving the body as those who are just initiated into the mysteries of the beyond. This is a fate which is awaiting each one of us without exception, you see. And are we prepared for this change? How can we withdraw our spirit, transcend the body at will, if we know that much practically, well, at the time of death we'll be going just as we are leaving one home and going out to somewhere else, you see. There will be no pain, you'll feel joy. Suppose you are transferred to some foreign land, what do you do? That place is one which you have not seen before. Naturally, you will just go through directories to tell you how will you be going on the foreign lands, you see, on what ships, what are the requirements, etc. like that. How careful we are, you see, in that way. But for an event which is inevitable, you see, we have to leave the body someday, each one of us. Do we know how to transcend the body? If we know now how to leave the body as well, then we put in more time to that way of life, you see. Naturally we will be prepared, you see. The sting of death will be no more. That is why, you see, understand the true prophets of life, who we are, what we are, and act accordingly. But we are acting quite in a different manner. We rise each day morning, and what we find? We are just take up the bed tea, read some newspaper, say the calls of nature, and just take some food, breakfast, and go to our work, whether it is a shop or a service or whatever it is. All during the day, you are working hard for earning money, just to support yourself and, to your, and your family. You come in the evening, you just purchase something what is required for the family, you see, attending some doctors in case there is any sickness at home, take the food at night, or just attend some meetings or some clubs and some cinemas. After that, you go to sleep. Again, the following morning, you rise, the same routine repeats, you see. Well, see, out of the 24 hours, how much time we are putting in for our own self? That's the point. When people are asked, well, do you care for the day of your life? He says, I've got no time. That's the general question. Then when they are told, well, dear friend, you have to leave the body somewhere, well, we will die when the death comes. That's all. They are not taking that thing at home, you see. The true importance of that, they are not taking it at home. Result is what? We see with our eyes, you see, how strange, how grand a delusion we are all, each one of us is passing. We see with our eyes that such like bodies are being left by something, now eliminating it. We have been the eyewitness to many cases. We have been sometimes attending the funerals of such bodies. We are sometimes helping to just put the such bodies on the ground as now. We are looking quite consciously. And with all that, it never strikes us that we have also to leave the body. Well, what more delusion could it possibly be? So we have to just consider the two values of life, you see. This is the first thing that we have to just consider calmly over it. We have to leave the body someday, you see. If we do not care by even seeing that much, attending such much, then who can be a man? You see, either he's not, I not got his brains in order, I would say, or just a child, you see, who has no sense yet developed, you see. Either of the two must be. When you see the bodies are being left, and we are having the same similar bodies, we have also to leave the body. We are the indwellers of the body, not the body themselves. Then if we do not work for it, well, how far we will continue to play like children, you see? After all, we have to leave this body. The Mormon saint says, we have dealt with our own self in a very, I say, indifferent way. He gives an example, as a blind man would not have dealt with himself, you see. We see, but we see not. Our eyes see, but we see not. It's a very clear thing, without any the slightest ray of doubt that we have to leave the body somewhere. Well, if we have to leave the body somewhere, what to do? Man's highest aim in life is to know oneself and to know God. If while having man body, which is the highest of all creation, if we do not do the special work that we can do in man's body only, and no other form of creation, who will call us a wise man, you see? If you are just, I have come here for 3 days or 4 days like that, well, I know I have to go. I live here, I will talk to everybody sweetly, live also somewhere, take my food too, but all the same I know I have to leave. You see, Hollywood, in 3 or 4 days' time. So I will be working here, but not attached to these things, you see. Because I know I have to go, you see. That's certain. The other way it is also certain that we have to go. But how we are behaving? This body is a house in which we live in. We have to vacate it someday. We are caring so much about the body and its environments and outer attachments at the cost of our own selves, I would say now. After all, we have to leave the body and go where? That naturally follows. But we do not care for all that. We will read scripture, excuse me. We will attend the holy place of worship. We will just doing from morn till night all other so many things, shadow performing, shadow this and that thing. With all that, we have not prepared ourselves how, when leaving the body, that experience can we have now. We should be able to leave the body at will 100 times a day. Kabir, the great saint of the East, tells us, I die daily, you see. This is what the Bible says. Just learn to die so that you begin to live. I die daily. So this is something before us, and we have to just be prepared for that. We are just stuck in the physical body, just like a prisoner is stuck in a dungeon, you see. We cannot transcend now. What? Who can help us that way? Maulana Rum, a great master of the East, of the Mohammedans, tells us, well, all men are stuck fast in the body, physical body, they know not how to transcend. He said, who can help them to give them that practical experience of transcending the body, come about the body consciousness? He said, it is his master, I am prophet. Then he prays, O Lord, O God, send us such like masters who just give us a personal experience how to come above the body. About rise above the body consciousness. This is a thing which is awaiting for each one of us. And unless we work up to that, live up to that, we have that personal experience in life, how to transcend the body, and by regular practice we can come above the body. Well, the fear of death will be there. If you know how to leave the body at will, this thing of death will be gone, you see. Kabir says, the people are afraid of hearing the name of death. Each one would like to stay an hour or so more, you see. But he says, why? Why is he afraid of hearing? Because one thing, he does not know how to leave the body. He is passed to the agony of death. The breathing stops. He is just gurgling inside, you see. First thing, he does not know how to be the body. And the other thing, he does not know where to go. He does not know who is to accompany him. There is no guide. But if he has sat at the feet of some master, some adept in that way, he would have given him the first and experience how to come above the body consciousness day to day, at will. Such a man naturally would not feel sad, but feel joy, you see. When you transcend the body, well, higher planes are the house of our God, our Father is more beautiful than the world, you see. Creator is more beautiful than all creation. you come about rise above the physical body and see yourself. You have got experience how to be beyond where you have to go. To such a man, that he says that I have overjoyed at this here in the name of the death of death, because I see I am united with go to my true home forever, go to return. So that's the difference between the two. You see. One man is dying in agony, leaving the body, the other man is rejoicing over his death. But the vast difference between the two. The difference is due to the fact the one man learns how to leave the body at home, how to transcend it to the beyond, has the first experience of that man. Such a man will rejoice, joyful, will be joyful when leaving the body, and say the name of the death. And the other man who has not looked that way, he is simply dreading the name of death. But at the time of death, what is happening?
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Satsang for Master Kirpal Singh. This morning our reader is Barbara Ann Grimes. Are you there, Barbara?
Yes, I am.
Okay, carry on.
Thank you. Excuse me. Continuing on in reading Guru Nanak and his teachings, which is found in the back of the 7th edition of the Japji. I'm going to just backtrack a bit to read a little bit of where we closed the last time. This body is verily the temple of God in which we reside and in which God also dwells. The whole universe is the abode of God and God dwells therein. All this can be experienced at the level of the spirit with the grace of a competent spiritual guide or mentor. As long as we do not perceive this unity of man, physically, mentally, and spiritually, and by the same controlling power within all of us, there can be no true integration and solidarity of humankind. A great preacher of peace and harmony. One day, the Guru, that is Guru Nanak, went into the river Ravi for a bath. A voice came to him from the music of the water saying, O Nanak, I am with thee, and I have given thee my name. To this name be thou dedicated. Repeat my name, Sat Nam. Mingle thou with men uncontaminated by the world. Worship my spirit and power, and meditate on my glory, and serve the poor and the needy as thyself. No sooner had he heard the call than he, like Buddha and Mahavira, left his hearth and home to bring men nearer to God so that they might enjoy in fullness the ecstatic bliss lying untapped within. People wondered why he was forsaking his wife and children. To their taunts, the Guru replied, I am leaving them to the care of him who cares for all of us. The world is in the grip of deadly flames, and I go to extinguish the invisible fire which is enveloping all mankind. If we look critically with the eye illumined by the Master, we will find that we are living in the holy hill of God. All places of worship have been made on the pattern of the human body, the God-made temple for our worship. The Hindu temples are dome-shaped at the top in the likeness of the human head. The mosques, besides the central and side domes, have arches in the shape of foreheads. The churches and synagogues have steeples tapering upward in the formation of a nose. Again, the faithful in the various religions believe that God is light and sound. The symbols of this inner light and sound adorn all our places of worship in imitation of the reality within. But the true worship lies in opening the inward eye, the single eye, or the Shiv Netra, to see the divine light, and in unstopping the inner ears to hear the divine music, the Akashbani or the Bani Ilahi. The outer performances, without having a glimpse of the spirit and power of God, the light and sound principle, are just like a blind man saying, God is light, though he has never known what light is. The manifestation of the Jyoti or Noor within is a vision of God, or having a darshan, as it is called. All this and more comes through the grace of a competent master. With this right perception and right understanding, there follow right speech and right actions, all on their own. The kingdom of God, for which we so fervently pray day in and day out, will then actually come on the earth plane. It comes, and I quote, not by observation. Lo, it is within thee, say all the sages and seers. Guru Nanak wanted to reform religion, to lift it from the formal and conventional to the simple and the practical. Etymologically, the term religion comes from the roots re, back, and ligio or ligore, to bind. Religion then is something that binds and unites the soul to the oversoul or God. When masters come, those who meet them and come into their close contact derive the maximum benefit of getting their souls linked with the manifested light and sound of God. The social religions came into being after the masters pass away. They are made, no doubt, with a noble purpose, the purpose of keeping the teachings of their founders alive. As long as practical men remain in the social orders, the followers continue to get the benefit as before. Later on, for want of such practical men, these social orders acquire rigid formations, and the very institutions set up with the noblest intentions and the best of motives become ironclad prison houses and begin to stagnate and stink with hair-splitting polemics in which the spirit gets lost under the mass of dead verbiage. The purpose of religious education is to draw out the best in man and make him an integrated whole, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. That religion is best which turns out more and more ideal persons with a harmonious development in all their parts. The highest objective of Sikh religion is to turn out Khalsas. A Khalsa is one who witnesses within him the supreme light of God in full effulgence. Similarly, a Hindu is one who makes manifest in him the Jyoti of Ishvara and listens to the unending and unstruck music of the soul, Anhad and Anhat Nad, the symbols of which he adores and worships outside in his temples and shrines by lighting candles and striking bells. A true Muslim is one who sees the Noor of Allah, or the light of God, and hears the Kalami Kadim, the voice of God, the most ancient music or song ceaselessly going on within him. A true Christian, likewise, is one who bears testimony to the light of God and hears the sound of God, which transforms him into an awakened spirit at the Mount of Transfiguration. Nanak put great emphasis on direct experience of the divinity that lies within us. For mere reading of the scriptures and observations, for mere reading of the scriptures and observing the rites and rituals of worship cannot take the place of the reality. These are the elementary steps, but not enough in themselves. Nanak was a poet saint and a bard of the open secret, a preacher of the spirit and power of God enlivening the humankind. He went from place to place, chanting the sacred name and preaching the love of God. He visited Hindu places of pilgrimages, the Muslim shrines, and other holy places. Closer is he than the very life breath, and nearer than the hands and feet. As Lao Tzu said, without going out of doors, we may yet know the essence of the world. This essence is called the Nam, the Sat Nam, the eternal word. His life was dedicated to preaching the practice of the holy word. He taught the people that in the holy word was hidden a great healing power which healed all the ills of life. He loved the Hindus and the Muslims alike. Speaking to the Hindus, he said, praise and glorify God 5 times as the Muslims offer prayers to Allah 5 times a day. Speaking to the Muslims, he said, make the will of Allah your rosary. Be ye a real Muslim after renouncing your little self. At this, quite a few Muslims involuntarily cried aloud, God is speaking to us in Nanak. Even when in Mecca, he taught the doctrine of strict monism, or the unity of Godhead, interpreting the wisdom of the Prophet, he uttered the name Allah with the same reverence as he did the name of Hari. On seeing him, Sheikh Farid greeted Nanak with the words, Allahu, or Thou art Allah. The Guru replied, Allah is the only aim of my life, O Farid. Allah is the very essence of my being. All call on the one God by different names, maybe Ram, Rahim, Allah, Wahigaru, and the like. There are many lovers of God, and he is the life-giving force to all of them. Although bearing the badge of different religions, all have the same ideal before them, to worship the indwelling spirit called by so many names. There is no caste, said the Guru, for we claim brotherhood with all. Each of his followers was lovingly addressed as a Baha'i, or a brother. All are Baha'is, brethren, whether kings or slaves, the rich or the poor. No caste and creed counts in the court of the Lord. He who worships him is dear unto him, said the Guru. He mingled freely with the poor, the downtrodden, the outcast, and the neglected. He accepted the invitations from the poor in preference to those of the rich, who, he knew, invited him for self-glorification, and whose earnings were anything but righteous. He considered that there was no sin greater than the spirit of separateness, which went against the solidarity of life in the brotherhood of man and worked for disruption in society. I will read that sentence again. He considered that there was no sin greater than the spirit of separateness, which went against the solidarity of life in the brotherhood of man and worked for the disruption in society. This prophet of unity and oneness saw the higher harmony in all the faiths in the religion of man, the worship of God, and the service of God in man. He wanted the followers of all faiths to sit together as seekers after truth, seeking communion with the Almighty. The highest religion teaches us to reverently study and experience in full consciousness the living presence of God as like-minded students in a class. When questioned at Mecca as to whether he was a Hindu or a Muslim, he frankly and fearlessly declared that he was neither the one nor the other in particular, because he discerned the Spirit of God in both. When asked which of the two religions, Hinduism or Islam, was superior, he said, "Without good acts, the professors of both the religions shall perish." In one of his hymns he says, "To him whose delusion of the mind is gone, Hindu and Muslim are alike." At Baghdad, the people questioned him as to which sect he belonged, and he replied, "I have renounced all sects. I only know the one true God, the supreme being who is on the earth, in the heaven, and in between, and in all directions." On being further pressed as to who he actually was, he replied, "This body, compounded as it is of the five elements, is being illumined by the light of God, and is just addressed as Nanak." Again and again he warned his disciples against the sin of separateness. In a beautiful passage he declared, "Numberless are thy worshippers, and numberless thy lovers. Numberless thy bhaktas and saints who lovingly fix their thoughts on thee. Numberless the musical instruments and the sound thereof, and so are thy musicians." In the course of his travels, he had with him two attendants, one a Hindu and the other a Muslim, Bhai Bala and Bhai Mardana. He poured his love to all, setting at naught all conventions, creeds, castes, and color bars. He was a brother of the poor, the criminal, and the persecuted. His socialism was vibrant with love of God and not atheistic in character. Growing out of the vision of God's love, it flowed into the hearts of men as brothers in God. A new Indian nation can be built even now, but not in blind imitation of the West. We must accept the vital message of the seers, the prophets, and the saints of the East, who are well conversant with the conditions of our society and have a rich spiritual heritage behind them. Guru Nanak, God intoxicated. From a very early age, Nanak was fond of meditation. He would go to a forest and for long hours sit there in rapt silence. He would meditate on the great mystery of life, a mystifying mystery indeed. Where does life come from? How does it work in us? How does the great controlling power sustain us from day to day? Is it possible to contact this power These were the vital questions that he posited for himself. Nanak's father tended to regard his son as insane. One day he called a physician to attend upon him. As the latter felt the pulse, Guru Nanak said, "O physician, I am not mad. I am only smitten with the pangs of love for God. They call me mad, but I'm not. I'm simply God intoxicated." Nanak was overflowing with the love and glory of God. He radiated love of God to all who came in contact with him. He was verily Word made flesh and dwelt amongst us. He opened the inner eye of those who came to him and enabled them to witness the light of God within them. He was the light of the world as long as he remained in the world. The light manifested itself in him, and he guided the tottering humanity with that light. This light never vanishes, but always remains in each one of us. We have to break the stone walls of our passions and prejudices of separateness and sectarianism in order to have a vision of the divine light in full splendor. The Guru, like all other masters, advised, "Kindle the light which is within you. Ye are the children of light. Be ye lamps unto yourselves." India and all other countries of the world need heaven's light for their guidance. This was the universal call of Nanak to the whole humanity. He offered the water of life and the bread of life, the light and the nod, as food to the starving souls of the people, having which nothing else remained to be had. God is love. And love is God, and the way back to God is also through love. He was love personified and inspired love in everyone. He always sang, "Teach me how to live immersed in thy meditation day and night. Grant, O Lord, that I may never think of aught save thee, and that I may sing of thee ever and evermore." And again, "O my heart, love God as the lotus loves the water. The more it is beaten by the waves, the more its love enkindles. Having received its life from water, it dies without water. O my heart, love God as the kshatriya loves the raindrops, who even when fountains are full and the land green, is not satisfied as long as it cannot get a drop of rain." And again, "Whichever side I cast mine eyes, there thou art. Parted from thee, I crack and die." To reach God, teaches Nanak, one must walk the way of love. Love God alone, and if you love others, your children, friends and relatives, love them for his sake. Yearn for him, develop within you an intense longing for him, and when you feel restless for him, know that it will not be long before he will reveal himself to you. He was the prophet of the inner light and urged that the inner should be expressed not in creeds and dogmas, rites and rituals, but in humble service of the poor and the lowly. And this service must be inspired by the love of God and Nam, the spirit and power of God. Nanak says, "O man, how canst thou be free without love? For the word of God, the Nam, will reveal to thee the Lord within thee and grant thee the treasure of love. Love filled, let the seeker become the bridegroom's bride. Filled with bhakti, the disciple be dyed in the true color of love. Such a bride shall never be a widow, for she abideth in the Satguru. On her free hand is the jewel of love, and except the bridegroom, she knoweth none. Awake, awake, O seeker, awake. Renounce the little wisdom of the ego. Love-filled, think ever of his lotus feet. Surrender thy body and thy soul to him. Surrender thyself, so mayest thou meet thy Lord. Guru Nanak was a true mystic in communion with God and perceiving his all-pervading munificent grace. He exclaimed, Nanak sees the Lord in all his glory. Intoxicated with the love of the Lord, he remained in a state of perpetual ecstasy. Once Babar offered Nanak a cup of hemp. The Guru politely declined, saying, O Emperor, the intoxication of this substance is just an ephemeral nature, but I am ever in a state of divine inebriation under the powerful influence of the Holy Nam. For meditation, Nanak prescribed a regular course of spiritual discipline, for without it one could not progress on the path. The first is devotion to Nam. In the opening lines of Japji, the daily morning prayer of the Sikhs, the God power is termed as Sat Nam, or eternal truth. It is in the name that the life of religion is rooted. So the name. Now is the season to throw away all doubts and misgivings. Burn to ashes all your silk and velvet fineries if they take you away from the name of the Lord. The Guru then sums up the qualities required of a devotee on the spiritual path. Purity of thought, speech, and deed is the first prerequisite for the dawn of higher life. Christ too said, Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Purity is verily the key that unlocks the door of meditation, leading to the mansion of the Lord. Secondly, one must develop patience and perseverance to bear cheerfully whatever good or evil may befall as a reaction to our own actions. Thirdly, one must have control over one's thoughts, casting away all desires so as to ensure equilibrium of the mind. Fourthly, a steady practice every day of the presence of the living God by communion with the Word in full faith in the Master of Power above. Fifthly, one must live in holy awe of His presence, stimulating one to untiring effort to achieve ultimate union with Him. And above all, one must love God with such an intensity as may burn up all dross in us, leaving us free to proceed unhampered to His kingdom. The Ideal Farmer. A lover of freedom, Guru Nanak spent his early days in the freedom of the farm and the open air of the countryside. As he grew older, he traveled far and wide, exhorting the people to free their minds of conventional thoughts and convivialities of life. On his return from his far-flung travels, he settled down at Kartarpur as a farmer. He was a true son of the soil, a passionate peasant who had cultivated much harder things than earth, the mind and intellect, etc. After man-making and man's service, he engaged himself in land service, for to grow a blade of grass and to raise a stalk bearing an ear of grain was to him much better than the work of a mere priest or a preacher. He set an example of hard labor by bringing under cultivation the barren lands of Kartarpur for feeding the poor and the needy and the produces thereof. He also set up at Kartarpur the institution of Langar, or a system of free community feeding, where both bread and broth were distributed freely to all according to the needs of each. Bread was the Lord, the Guru declared, and the bread which the Lord gave was his prasad, God-given. Bread and water belong to the Guru, echoed the followers, and the Guru said that the Beloved was in the people. His disciples came from far-off places like Baluchistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, and included among others the Brahmins and the Sufis, the high caste Kshatriyas and the low caste Chandalas, the Siddhas and the Naths. Thus, his following was a conglomeration of all sorts of people knit together in the bonds of loving devotion to the holy cause and vying with each other in the labor of love for the fallen and the downtrodden. Nanak, their spiritual father, now advanced in age, moved on foot every day, laboring in the farms and singing hymns of Nam and breathing the benediction of love. The Guru was a picture of humility, and his followers, in a spirit of dedication, worked as humble servants of the Lord, worshiping God without any pomp and show in the stillness of nature. From Kartarpur spread the fire of the love of God and the love of man all over the Punjab. Guru Nanak's face shone with the simplicity and serenity born of the saintliness in him. He was a laborer, a tiller of the soil, a servant of the poor and lowly. The life at Kartarpur was a blend of willing work and worship, love and labor, silence and song. And we'll stop here and thank you, Master, for this satsang. Amen.
Thank you, Barbara, for the wonderful reading. Today we had 76 people at the satsang. Thank you, everybody, for attending. And thank you, Master, for providing this for us. Now please hang up your phone.